Hi, I'm Alex Beam. I'm a living arts columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you very much to the people who've written me kind letters praising my work. Alas, there will be none of those quoted in this podcast because I really like to focus on the critical letters. One of my many mottos is praise saps the strength. And in a way, it's only through criticism that my own wits stay sharp. And I'm happy to say the reader's wits stay sharp, too. The first column I'm going to be using that got a significant amount of reaction appeared on February 5th. But it used in the lead, of course, a story of Barbaro, the fantastic Kentucky Derby-winning thoroughbred that eventually gave up the horse Ghost after many months under the care of University of Pennsylvania veterinarians. And I kind of poked fun at Barbaro. I almost called him Saint Barbaro because there was an online tribute slash comment slash obituary notebook that was published at the University of Pennsylvania, and literally over 100 people filed their touching tributes to this magnificent horse. My mother was one of them. My mother, I really think to this day, hasn't gotten over the passing of Barbaro. In any case, one reader from Lexington, Massachusetts wrote in stridently, and I quote, "Barbaro was no nag. Good thing you were not around when Man of War died." Man of War, of course, was another legendary Kentucky Derby winner. "He was embalmed and put into a casket. The funeral was a big event in Kentucky. His grave is still a big attraction in Lexington. You would really have freaked out over that." Well, not really, although I must say, when I wrote this column, and as I do this podcast, by the way, the final resting spot of Barbaro has still not been selected, although it's stopped short of having the horse embalmed and put into a casket. There was one other hostile reaction to this column, although now that I look at it, it's really nicely written and quite direct. John Tanofsky of Boston wrote to me, and I quote, "Your recent column on Barbaro is quite possibly the most asinine op-ed piece I've ever read. It's simply appalling and, quite frankly, personally insulting. I cannot discern a single valid point from it." I'm amazed that a piece about a horse could in some way be personally insulting to John Tanofsky. But in any case, I'll go on. His letter continues, "Just because people love Barbaro and hate you doesn't mean you should feel free to rail against the cause." I continue to quote, "Spend some time around some of the beautiful raceways in the country, Saratoga, Churchill Downs, Gulfstream, Santa Anita, and perhaps only then will you be able to appreciate, which only some of us can, the kinship of horses, racing, and equine awareness. Thank you, John Tanofsky." And here's a letter, a very cogent letter, written in response to a column that was published on February 7th about a charity that was set up by Tom Scott and Tom First, the so-called Juice Guys of Nantucket Nectar fame. Nantucket Nectar is a huge brand here, as I'm sure you know. It's sort of a fruit-like beverage. I called it a sugary sludge, which wasn't very charitable, but if you look on the side of the bottle, it's perfectly accurate. Nantucket Nectars costs almost $3 a bottle and has all this gibberish on the side of the bottle about how good it is and how healthy it is. But you might want to compare it to a Coke can sometime and see that gram for gram, drinking a Nantucket Nectar is no better for you than drinking a Coke. In any event, the column was pretty harsh because it attacked the charity that the Juice Guys had set up that really hadn't existed for 3 years. Now, in their defense, this huge conglomerate named Cadbury Schweppes had taken over Nantucket Nectars. However, they were still hyping the charity on the website, and I, in fact, had been approached by a man who was trying to get a grant from the Juice Guys, which was actually the name of the charity. It was called Juice Guys Care. And he discovered, through a little bit of sleuthing, that this had been a completely dormant entity for 3 years. But a man named Forbus from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, wrote in to take me to task. He's clearly a big fan of the two Juice Guys, Tom Scott and Tom First, and he launches into his letter, and I quote, "Are you a gossip columnist or a reporter? Your opening paragraph for Juice Guys is borderline libel." Now, I have to stop quoting there because I'm something of an expert on libel. I've seen libel from both sides now, Mr. Forbus, and I didn't come anywhere near libel because when we start publishing libel, We call in those fancy lawyers from the New York Times with their suits, and we did not have to call in any fancy lawyers for this. So it was not, as you say, borderline libel. However, I resume your letter. Your depiction of Nantucket Nectars being, quote, the wildly overpriced sugary sludge drink originally marketed by the notorious juice guys is much more opinion than fact. Then he takes me to task sternly. He says, quote, why are you using the word notorious to define two guys who started this foundation in the first place? Mr. Forbes, that's an excellent question. And our copy desk, our ever-alert copy desk, asked me the same question. Famous means well-known, or famous and notorious, of course, means known for the wrong reasons. And maybe it was a little bit unfair of me to call the two Toms notorious. When the copy desk asked that question, I explained somewhat tongue-in-cheek that anyone younger than I and more successful than I had to be notorious to me, and that would certainly apply to the two Toms. But indeed, they have no particular notoriety, as the reader correctly points out, meaning they don't live in infamy. They're not famous for anything negative. Anyway, this terrific letter ends by saying, why is it that whenever I have firsthand information about anything covered in the news, you news reporters get it wrong 98% of the time? Oh, that's right, Mr. Forbes writes. You're not in business to deliver news, but to sell newspapers with sensational reporting. Is that what they're teaching in journalism school these days? End of letter. Gosh, I don't know, never having attended journalism school. But with all due respect to myself, this particular column was not 98% wrong. It was 100% right. But thank you for writing, Mr. Forbes. On February 14th, I wrote a pretty powerful column about the trial of Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's aide, who Prosecutor Fitzgerald is trying to put away for supposedly leaking information about the identity of Valerie Plame, who was undercover at the CIA. This trial's gotten an incredible amount of attention in the Boston Globe and every other newspaper in America, also in the Evening News. I think the trial is a complete fraud, and I made that case very powerfully in the column, which I think you can pick up very quickly if you read it. The reason I feel it's a fraud is that if you remember what the so-called crime was, the crime was that a columnist named Robert Novak revealed the fact that Valerie Plame was a CIA agent in his widely syndicated column. And even George Bush said, this is a serious crime, and I'd like to find out who leaked this information. Well, 3 years later, we know who leaked the information. It's a now-retired Deputy Secretary of State named Richard Armitage, who actually was born in Boston, Massachusetts. And we know now that the government didn't have the guts to prosecute either Armitage or Robert Novak, who is the person who committed the crime of disclosing the CIA agent's identity. Instead, Patrick Fitzgerald has spent $2 million of taxpayer money prosecuting Scooter Libby. Scooter Libby did not reveal the CIA agent's identity to Robert Novak. It has come out in the trial that he revealed her identity to other journalists. However, that was generally after Novak had already published his column. So Libby in no way is culpable of the original crime that shocked the nation. Several people wrote in to take me to task, as I knew they would, because this trial is a political touchstone, basically. It's just a substitute, really, for hatred of the Bush and Cheney administration. And that's a point I made in the column. I think people should be free to hate the Cheney-Bush administration, but that should be very different from attempting to put people in jail for crimes they didn't commit. In any case, here's Gregory Luce, a reader, asking if the column was, quote, supposed to be, well, humorous. And then he points out to me, it's been stated since the beginning of this trial that Mr. Libby is on trial, now he goes into capital letters, for impeding the Plame investigations. Capital letters in the hope that you will actually retain this information. Then he explains to me, because I'm thick, if Libby had not attempted to withhold information to protect Cheney, then the investigation would have proceeded. In fact, after the Libby trials, Mr. Fitzgerald's mandate will still be in effect, as has been his practice in other cases. I'm sure that he will continue to follow the foul trail wherever it leads. Well, I'm almost certain that there will be no follow-up to the Libby trial, but that's fine. Gregory Luce disagrees with me. Then he goes on, this is what we're all waiting for, he goes on to attack me personally. He says, what could your intent have been in writing? Frankly, I haven't the slightest idea. However, I would suggest, seeing that you are auditioning for the National Critics job, that you pay closer attention to your own paper. I have no idea what he means by the national critic's job. But then he explains more clearly that I'm a pawn of a vast New York-based conspiracy. Interesting, Gregory Luce writes, that the Boston Globe is owned by the New York Times, the paper that, more than any other, carried the administration's water in getting the U.S. into Iraq. Why, Mr. Beam, are you planning to move to New York? Judy Miller's position is available. This is deep sardonic wit, referring to Judith Miller, the widely pilloried national security reporter for the New York Times, a woman with whom I actually have a great deal of sympathy, but I won't get into that here. But in any case, Luce is using Miller and the New York Times as a stick to beat me over the head. Lastly, a reader named Bernard Schreiber made a point to me that many, many other readers made, and that actually buttresses the point I was trying to make in the column, that this is merely a piece of political jurisprudence, exactly, if you will, like the Whitewater prosecution of the Clintons. Schreiber writes, quote, "Everyone seems to forget the amount of money wasted on investigating the Clintons. What did we get for the $50 million there? Nothing. How is it that when Republicans waste millions and billions and even trillions of dollars, no one is up in arms, and virtually no one reports unfavorably about it, and you're worried about $2 million. I mentioned in the column that the Fitzgerald investigation might cost around $2 million. Schreiber goes on, "The mainstream media in this country is amazingly bereft of any ability to keep their eyes on the true prize because, like the current administration, you are beholden to big money interests. Great job. God, Mr. Schreiber, I wish I was beholden to big money interests, because then I'd live in a much bigger house and my children would go to much nicer schools and I wouldn't drive my four-year-old, clunky, prone to engine failure, Toyota Prius. But thank you for your thoughts. Please continue to share your thoughts with me. Please write in. Without you, there would be no podcast. Without you, there would be no one worth offending. I'm Alex Beam. You can reach me by email, Beam. My last name is spelled like a beam of light, beam@globe.com. Thank you so much for reading, and thank you so much for caring. Bye-bye.